Our host needs no introduction.
His name is...
A name so simple it rolls right off your tongue.
His name is James... No, his name is... James Lawrence! Lawrence! Lawrence!
Try again.
Forrest Lone... Lars! Lars! No!
Chuck Jaffe.
Yes! 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 We're like this!
I'll say it again so you remember, okay? This is Money Life with Chuck Jaffe.
Wow! 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 All I can say is wow!
Please do not overdramatize these proceedings.
And now, here's Chuck.
He's one in a million.
He sure is.
Well, all I can say is wow, because this is Money Life. It's Money Life for May the 5th. I can't believe it's already May the 5th. May the 5th be with you. Yes, I know. Yesterday was May the 4th. It was Star Wars Day. No, we didn't mention it on the show. And trust me, if it were Star Trek Day, maybe we would have mentioned it on the show. Maybe. Not because I am a Trekkie. Because I'm not a Trekkie. But Bob Robertson, my original producer on the show, he is a Trekkie. And he'd like us all to believe...
Resistance is futile.
Yeah, that resistance is futile. That, of course, from the Borg.
Resistance is futile.
Yeah. Yeah, I know. It was May the 4th. May the 4th be with you. Star Wars Day. I'm not that geeky and nerdy. Sorry. I'm not. But we're May the 5th now. May the 6th. Well, May the 6th is a playoff game for the New England Black Wolves lacrosse team. So I'm excited. I've got that coming. It's been a very, very busy time. But we've got great things coming on the show. I wish we had the show that we had planned for you. We don't, but it means that we're not going to have the show we planned for you tomorrow either, so that may make things better. Now, the show we had planned for you included Ned Riley from Riley Asset Management. He was supposed to be here talking about the market. But when Ned accepted my invitation to come on the show today, he thought he was accepting the show, the invitation to come on the show tomorrow. So he told me one thing and he put something else 24 hours later in his calendar. So Ned is going to be on the show tomorrow. We're going to have Ned on. We will not do our technical difficulty segment and we'll find a way to squeeze a little extra into tomorrow's show. Meanwhile, on today's show, well, it's Thursday. So you get Tom Lydon and Bob Powell, our regulars. And then you get Brian Beitner. He is managing director and partner at Chautauqua Capital Management, which just opened on Monday of this week two new funds that he runs, the Chautauqua International Growth Fund and the Chautauqua Global Growth Fund. And if you just read my most recent column, well, last week, it talked about the fact that international and global and even large cap domestic kind of confuse investors in many ways, and that the labels don't really fit anymore because you're looking at an international fund and you're going, okay, it's an international fund, but it owns some big stock that makes most of its money domestically. And you're looking at a domestic situation where you buy the S&P 500 and you're getting a third of your revenues from outside the country. So we'll talk with him about that, about the new funds, about what he sees happening in the market and more. And then to replace Ned Riley, well, you get some extra time with me. A couple of you have sent some interesting questions that I want to take the time to answer, but not in the usual way I answer questions where I'm doing a question and answer. You guys have sent some, it's not even necessarily that you've sent questions. It's sort of been comments about some interviews we've done and they're asking questions about how you maybe apply some of the lessons that you learn here into your own portfolio. And so that's what I'm going to talk with you about, because I'm worried that the fact that we do stuff here every day makes you think you need to do something for your portfolio every day. And all that's going to do is leave you with a portfolio that's bloated. So I'll talk some more about that as well. That's going to come up between Tom Lydon and Bob Powell, and then we'll get to Brian Beitner, and that's going to be our show today. Now, tomorrow on this show, assuming everything goes according to plan, which it hasn't all week, so maybe it won't, you're going to have Ned Reilly now, then Jack Ablin from BMO Private Bank, and Jeff Oxshore from the Oxshore Focus Fund. So it's going to be a good day tomorrow, and of course, Greg McBride. It's going to be a good day tomorrow. Of course, it's going to be a good day today, I think, too. I'm Chuck Jaffe, senior columnist for MarketWatch, your host here every weekday. Money Life is independent personal finance talk, and we're dedicated to looking smartly at a wide range of approaches and opinions on investing. It is not just what I like or want to talk about. It is what my guests can bring you, and it can be anywhere across the realm. Because even if it's something I disagree with, I think you are better off hearing from smart people and learning what you can from them. We'd love for you to be more involved in the show. At Money Life Show is our Twitter. I've been bad about tweeting this week. I've been so busy with other stuff. At MKTW Jaffe is my MarketWatch Twitter. I've got a column going up today. I should have another one coming up tomorrow. So hopefully you will get a chance to check those out too. I know some of you do read my columns and some of you don't. It's okay. I don't mind. If you want to get involved on the show itself and you want to send me a note, questions, comments, tickers for Hold It or Fold It and more, I'm at Chuck@MoneyLifeShow.com. So that's it. It's Money Life for May the 5th. Thank you so much for joining me. We're going to try to make this the best show we can. Again, our lineup for today: Tom Lydon to me, then Bob Powell on Senior Focus, and Brian Beitner. We'll start things off with the ETF of the week when Money Life really picks up speed right after this message.
Looking for alternative ETF strategies? Direction provides separate and distinct audiences with flexible investment tools to manage risk and execute short-term strategies. For more information, go to directionshares.com.
Well, I don't favor talking to vermin, but I'll talk to you just this once.
Exchange-traded funds are the investment world's new frontier.
Better listen.
But with so many choices and styles, the ETF world is a bit like the Wild Wild West, filled with new issues and ideas, but fraught with the same old dangers of investing.
If you're looking for trouble, I'll accommodate you.
Every Thursday, Tom Lydon of ETF Trends comes to Money Life to tell us about one ETF that is wearing the white hat right now.
Take it easy. We're the good guys.
He'll point out the good, the bad, and the ugly as he tells you which investment is worth taking a shot on.
That's good shooting.
And names his ETF of the week.
Wild West.
And I am pleased to be joined right now, as I am each time this week, each week at this time, by Tom Lydon. Tom is the editor of ETF Trends. He brings us the ETF of the week each week. But if you want to find out what he's doing when he's not here, and man, is he ever busy, go to ETFtrends.com, where they don't just put up Tom's picks or that sort of stuff. ETFtrends.com, a site that'll give you everything you need to know about the ETF business from soup to nuts. They're on Twitter at ETFtrends. Tom is on Twitter. He is at Tom Lydon. Tom, welcome back to the show.
Great to be back, Chuck.
Our ETF of the week is
the iShares Silver Trust, ticker symbol SLV.
The SLV, the iShares Silver Trust. And why silver now, Tom?
We haven't talked about silver in a long time, Chuck. I'm looking back over the years, and I know we've talked a little bit about gold, but most of the precious metals have lost their luster tremendously in the last few years. However, so far year to date, we're seeing a bit of a resurgence. The key, though, is, and why we're bringing up silver at this point, is silver has been handsomely outperforming gold so far year to date. So there are a few reasons. Number one, as we were sitting on New Year's Day, many investors expected that the Fed was going to hike interest rates four times over the course of the year. Right now, there are many that feel that we won't see two or even one. And with that in mind, because both gold and silver are denominated in dollars, we see more favorable outlook on the precious metals. So that's been very, very good. Less hikes in interest rates, more people can buy gold and silver, especially those that are outside the U.S., because we have a weaker dollar. That's a good thing. But also when you look at demand, there's always demand from a investment standpoint for a precious metal, surely on jewelry as well, both gold and silver. But we've seen a pretty good resurgence or continued growth in areas like technology, areas like automobile manufacturing, that all hold a certain amount of silver in a certain way. So there's the industrial component, there's the inflation component, there's the Fed component, and then also the fact that there's demand around the world for precious metals all point to silver continuing to outperform gold at this point.
So what kind of outperformance are we expecting? And is this, I assume, a 200-day moving average play? And if so, how far above the average are we?
Great questions. So it is a 200-day average play for sure. I think there are probably a lot of investors that have a certain component either in commodity-based stocks or in the commodities themselves. Again, with ETFs today, it's amazing how you not only can buy energy companies, but you can actually buy spot oil itself. And the same with gold and the same with silver. There are even platinum and palladium ETFs out there if you want to get real specific. Regarding the trend is definitely up. And at this point in time, we're about 7% above the 200-day moving average on SLV. So if you feel like this trend may continue, and again, we had a downtrend for about 3 years, and we've only just started this new trend, if you feel like it's going to continue, you can go in, punch on your computer in Yahoo Finance or Morningstar or Bloomberg, SLV, put the 200-day average, buy in as long as it maintains above the 200-day average. We've had a pretty good spike off of the beginning of the year lows, but again, with silver and gold, you're going to see a little bit more volatility in the marketplace, but there's also an opportunity for more gain. I know your next question, Chuck, is what do you do about allocation in your portfolio?
Yep.
And to that degree, it's basically if you don't have it already, if you don't have any type of precious metals, spot precious metals, which most people don't, I would recommend a more tactical outlook. Don't put more than 5% of your portfolio in this. And if you do use it, be sure to stick to the moving average. I think more and more, Chuck, you and I have had more discussions about tactical plays as the equity market's a little long in the tooth and also the fixed income markets. So if you have the desire and you've got the time to monitor your portfolio on a daily basis at least, here's an opportunity where something is, after a long-term downtrend, just above its 200-day average for the first time in a while. And many times that might provide an opportunity. No guarantees. It could easily tomorrow start heading south and go below the trend line, but that's something to consider.
Is this the kind of thing when you're looking at precious metals that you want to try to make sure you limit it to a very specific set of your overall portfolio that you're, you know, how much are you willing to commit to this?
Yeah, again, I think keep it to less than 5% for sure.
But is that, I guess my bigger point was, 5% in silver if you already have a gold allocation, et cetera?
I think most investors don't have a specific spot position. If you do, then you're already enjoying it, whether it's gold or silver or a combination of the both. So at this point in time, if you own it already, congratulations. If you don't, I think the thing is, many people ask, can this continue? We're going to continue to see pressure on the Fed, and as long as we don't see more rate hikes, I think gold and silver are going to continue to head north.
And that's why the iShares Silver Trust, the SLV, is the ETF of the week from Tom Lydon, editor of ETF Trends. Tom, thanks so much.
Thanks, Chuck.
If you want more information, go to ETFTrends.com. On Twitter, at ETF Trends. Tom's on Twitter as well, at Tom Lydon. That was a great way to start the show. I'll be back with more. We'll be talking about some stuff I've been looking at in the fund industry when Money Life comes back, and then Bob Powell and a big interview after that. So stay tuned. We're living the Money Life.
Hightower is a groundbreaking team of financial advisors committed to giving you access to best-in-class financial products and services, a practice often overlooked by brokers on Wall Street. Visit HightowerAdvisors.com to learn more about the Hightower difference.
Welcome back to Money Life. I'm Chuck Jaffe, senior columnist for MarketWatch, host of this show every weekday. And I got a couple of questions from folks of late, and I don't want to answer their questions specifically, but they kind of have to do with stuff we've talked about on the show, and they kind of have to do with stuff I've talked about in some columns, and it gives me an opportunity to chat with you and sort of encourage you in a way that I don't always think we do on this show. Because I think if there's a problem with the show, it is sort of the problem that you have anytime you do something every day like this. And that, of course, is what we face, is that we do this show every single day. And that perhaps gives you an impetus to try to act every day. And you shouldn't. I mean, what do I say at the end of every show? I say, remember that the best thing you can do until we do this again the next time is, the best thing you can do for your money is to not worry too much about it. And I know that there are different levels of you as audience members. There are the guys who are into this every single day with the big list of stocks, and you're building your own well-diversified portfolios, and you are managing your money, and this for you is something you really want to do. And then there are those of you who are somewhat new to things. You're sort of doing this on your own. You're trying to make sure you're thinking smartly about money and what have you. And to me, you have to find your own level. You know, I believe you can do it in any way, shape, or form. But it brings it back to a couple of questions that I've got recently. Now, we had Kathy Boyle from Chapin Hill Advisors on the show, and she was talking about basically a Corin Satellite or Corin Explore type of portfolio. And in response to her appearance, we had some people sort of saying, well, how do you decide what you want to explore with? And they pointed out that I've mentioned Corin Explore because my fundamental portfolio is basically Corin Explore. I want to have a couple of basic bedrock things in my portfolio. Index funds, cheap, long-term, what I want. And then I want to explore around that with the areas that I like. For example, I'm a big believer personally in microcap stocks. I like microcaps because small companies can give you a little bit more juice, and I think it's an exciting part of the economy to invest in. It is almost entirely domestic when you're looking at most of the mutual funds, and I think it's an area where good management can add a lot to it. So I like microcap. If you want to go global, there are some global players, but however you want to do it, fine. I'm going to want to have an explore portion of microcaps. I think some people want to do explore with managers. Like if you hear about a great manager on the show or anywhere else, you might say, okay, let me go get my index funds and make that my core, and then I want to explore. But, and we're going to talk about this later today when we have Brian Beitner on the show, because he's managing a global fund and an international fund. I don't think you have to make this excessively complex. So what's right for me might not be right for my sister-in-law. And I point this out because when my sister-in-law was taking control over her assets after the death of my brother, she asked me to be involved in helping to size up the financial advisors. She had decided she wasn't going to use the advisor my brother had gone to, mostly because of the distance involved. My brother had picked somebody who was a good ways away, and Eileen doesn't like to drive so much. She was thinking she'd do something closer to home. Fine. Not a problem. So I helped vet the person that she was talking to. And then the person basically gave her sort of the portfolio built by the book. Let's give you enough diversification and what have you so that you can have a portfolio. Now, this gets down to what questions I've been getting. They go, how many funds should I own? Well, they came back with a portfolio for my sister-in-law that was like a dozen funds. But it was a dozen funds that had a lot of overlap and were a bunch of partial steps. What do I mean by partial steps? Well, if you read my columns, you know that I had one out a week ago that was looking at how we sort of have labeled growth, domestic large caps, but they have a lot of international exposure versus international funds versus global funds. Some of the stuff we'll be talking with Brian Beitner about a little bit later. And that the problem that you have is that if you buy a domestic large cap fund, you're buying stocks like Coca-Cola or McDonald's or what have you, who get a bunch of their revenues from international sales. You could say you have an America Abroad fund if you bought enough domestic companies that were making 40 to 60%. I mean, heck, if you buy an S&P 500 index fund, you're getting over a third of the revenues on average coming from international sales. So do you then need to go and get something that is domiciled someplace else? And if you get something that's domiciled someplace else, if you buy Toyota because it's an international stock, well, Toyota makes a huge chunk of its money in the U.S. So how do you want to play this? Now, look, there are perfect ways to do this and, you know, what people consider optimal. And if you're an endowment or you're a money manager or you're a junkie, you just love to do this stuff, then by all means, go out there and get it done. But if you're like my sister-in-law, you need to have exposure to domestic and international, but you don't need to have a lot of overlap. You need to have a portfolio that is simple, not because she's simple by any stretch of the imagination, but because she doesn't feel comfortable with money management. So she wants for her to not be dependent on someone else. And when my brother was around, it wasn't a big deal. He loved this stuff. But for her not to be dependent on me, she wants to be able to say, okay, give me four or five funds that cover everything I need, that I can learn what I should expect from them, and I can get comfortable with them. Armed with that, she can move forward very easily. Is she building the optimal portfolio? No, she's not. But it is the optimal portfolio for her. It's not the optimal by some textbook, but she's not a textbook. And neither are you. And this is where, when we try to answer questions like, how do you do Core and Explore? Well, you could say, I'm going to just go get a couple of basic index funds. Do what Jack Bogle suggests you do. And, you know, total stock market fund or S&P 500 index fund if you don't want the international exposure, then a total bond market fund. You could do an age-weighted portfolio or what have you. And then around it, you could play. Now, you could play and say, I want to go buy, I don't know, the ETF of the week, right? Tom Lydon was talking about silver being a nice play. You could take a play on something that is timely, if that's what you wanted to do. Or you could say, wait, I want to take a flyer on some great manager who's been on the fund. And maybe you heard Andrew Foster from the Seafarer Fund, and you go, I don't have any emerging markets. If I've got that S&P 500 index fund and the total bond market index fund, let me go get some emerging markets by buying that fund. Okay, fine. You can pick how you explore around your core. Now, if you're a trend investor, the way Tom Lydon talks about it, well, you're going to be doing something that's more timely. And you're going to be looking for things that are trading above their 200-day moving average, and you'll sort of have the passive part of your portfolio. This is my core. I hold these things in all conditions, whatever's happening. And here's my explore, where my explore is managed with ETFs based on 200-day moving averages. Fine. That's a perfectly okay way to do it. If you said, I want to do my core, all passive investments, and then I want to go get some good managers around it, fine. All okay. Now, the one thing you want to avoid is getting too many funds in one category, because when that happens, you basically get what's called a closet index fund. If you bought four different large cap growth funds, even if they all have different managers, the problem is that when one of those funds decides, hey, I want to buy McDonald's, the other one is going, nah, I'm going to sell McDonald's. And they're doing it, and you wind up paying the freight. And that's unfortunate. For you to get unique performance in an asset class, you want no more than one or two funds. And expenses do matter. You know, so if you're just paying expenses so that the funds can trade with each other, that's really ineffective. I mean, Vanguard recently announced that it had cut some of its expense ratios in fiscal 2015, and the result was about $215 million in savings to their shareholders. That's just an example. Pennies add up. You know, if you can save a couple of pennies here and there, you should. You definitely should. So you don't want to be paying, thinking I'll get unique performance, but pay for so many funds in a group that it's bad. So how many is the right? Well, here's the other thing that I know from experience. I think that people, when they get into managing their money, tend to get into it and think that more is better. I own more funds. I am more fully diversified. I have more of everything, etc. Or they're doing it with stocks and they're doing it the same way. Let me build my portfolio because I need to be diversified. Let me get a lot of names. Then you're going to wind up going through what my father did. My dad was so conservative that he basically sat out the 1980s. And the good news was my mom was the risk taker. And together they had a great portfolio. Hers was too risky. His was too risk averse. Then as he sort of left his work environment, he got very much into managing his money and realized what he could do. And he became very savvy. But he also took on a lot of additional funds and stocks. His stock portfolio at one point had like 25 holdings, which it had never had much in the way of that, et cetera. It had 25 holdings and none of them were particularly large. And the way my dad was now looking at it, that meant a lot of time for him. Did he mind? No, he was fully retired now and he had time to do it. So when he was 65-ish, that was great. But when my dad was 75, he was going, oh, it's a lot of work. And I kind of feel I have to do it because I've got my money tied up in it. And he started simplifying his portfolio. He got rid of a bunch of positions. He found reasons to get rid of positions. And he basically said, I only want to own about 10 stocks. I only want to own whatever mutual funds I need to have to be well diversified. And he got back and found a number that, again, was it ideal? Nope. My father could never buy a small cap fund. He just couldn't do it. It never passed his sniff test. So he didn't have that part of the style box checked off. That's not ideal. That's not optimal, but it never bothered him. And so ultimately for you, the right answer to these questions is going to depend on how you feel about stuff. If you don't want to invest internationally, buy domestic stocks that have a lot of foreign exposure. You will get some international markets exposure. If you don't want to invest in both a domestic and an international fund, then buy a global fund and let a money manager decide how much of your money is staying onshore and how much is going overseas. There are a lot of different ways to do this, and there isn't one right way. I'd love to be able to tell you, oh, this is it. But I think it's more important that you recognize that if you are taking control, you're not messing it up, no matter what you do. Unless you go off to day trading penny stocks or something ridiculous like that. If you're taking, let me go buy something, let me decide where I'm going to put it. There's not terrible moves, no matter how you do it. Yeah, you can make mistakes that would be costly. But believe it or not, you're more likely to make a costly mistake by going, hey, I heard about this great fund and I bought it and I put it in a taxable account. And you didn't pay attention to the fact that the fund throws off a lot of capital gains. So now, yes, you're making money, but you're paying capital gains and you might have a year like we just went through in 2015 where your fund is kind of lackluster. The gain is kind of enormous. You pay the taxes on that anyway. There's a cost paid for being tax inefficient. So I think ultimately you need to look and say, what am I comfortable with? And more importantly, what am I going to be comfortable with in the future? I got a message recently from somebody, and I wish you had left me your name and had written me from an email address that worked, because I tried to respond back to say I wanted to actually have a phone call. But I got a note from somebody who basically was saying that right now. They've gotten into the market. The show has really helped them. We're doing all this great stuff. They're building their portfolio, and they keep adding to it, and they've got a lot of names. And I simply wanted to ask, do you want that many names when there comes a point in time that you'd rather be spending your hours doing other stuff? Have you built a portfolio that is right for you for your own future? Now, you hear me talk about my rules. I try to do everything I can as simply as possible. I don't own a lot of funds. Less than 10, for everybody who wants to know. It is less than 10. And that's including 401ks, self-directed IRAs, everything else. I try to keep things simple. I have a stock portfolio. I don't have a lot of names in it. I'm a big believer that you can keep things simple and reach your goals. But you have to keep things in a way that's going to help you be confident. And that's what we want you to do. So please don't think, hey, I got to do this. There's a right way. There's a wrong way. Uh-uh. There's your way. And whatever your way is, try to make it work. See what you can do to get comfortable with it. And don't think, oh, I've got to be just like this or just like that. I got to do what somebody tells me is optimal. No. Save your money. Invest your money. Move towards your goals, and you are doing the right thing. The rest of it, I promise, will come together. It really will. If you've got questions, send them to me, Chuck at moneylifeshow.com. Please send them from a real email address where I can respond. If I want to, put your name and your hometown. I don't need any more than that. I just like to know who I'm talking with. All right. Up next, Bob Powell's in for Senior Focus. And then that interview I told you about with Brian Beitner. But we'll talk a little bit more about some of the categorization issues here on the show. This is Money Life.
Customize an investment portfolio with FlexShares, ETFs designed to pursue targeted goals and to adapt to changing market conditions with both equity and fixed income solutions. For more information, go to FlexShares.com.
Your retirement years are coming. Are you financially ready for your retirement?
You know, I've been thinking.
Oh, that would explain the beads of sweat.
Don't let this happen to you.
I'm afraid it's just not sufficient to refinance your home.
Where shall I go? What shall I do?
My advice to you is to start drinking heavily.
Just a minute, ladies and gentlemen. I think something is happening.
Bob Powell knows where to turn and how to help you with your financial needs as you plan for or live in retirement.
Here I come to save the day.
It's all here as Retirement Weekly's Bob Powell joins Money Life every week for Senior Focus.
Senior citizens, although slow and dangerous behind the wheel, can still serve a purpose.
Oh, yes, they can, but they serve that purpose a lot better if they know what's happening with, for, and about their money. And Bob Powell can help them do that because Bob is the editor at Retirement Weekly. If you want more information, well, Bob is also a columnist for MarketWatch. Find his columns on MarketWatch, and you'll find links to Retirement Weekly because it's also a MarketWatch product. You can find Bob on Twitter. He's at RJPIII. Right now, he's here. Bob, welcome back to the show.
Chuck, thanks for having me on.
You are talking this week about a study that, well, when I saw it, I was thinking I should have somebody on the show talking about it because we do some stuff on survey research, and then I just have you to talk about it, which is great. But this is a survey that was done by Transamerica, and I can't tell when I looked at it whether it's good or bad, and you're trying to figure that out, right?
Well, yeah, so the entire report is about 120 pages, and it's chock full of, you know, great stuff, and you'd probably be well-served to invite Catherine Collinson on to talk about it. What grabbed me was this one finding that suggested that estimated median annual household income among retirees is just $32,000, and that more than half of retirees surveyed, 53%, live on less than $50,000. And it got me thinking, you know, how is that possible? And how can you live on $32,000? And And if so, how would you go about doing it? And so I talked to Catherine and I talked to other financial planners and came up with a couple tips that might help people explain how it is you can do it if you have to, or if you anticipate living on a modest income, what to expect. So the first thing is, and maybe this is stating the obvious, it won't be easy to live on such little income. And in fact, in the survey, 42% of them report having difficulty making ends meet. And a lot of them say that they're having trouble, and we'll get to this in a second, but, you know, with basic living expenses, ultimately. I did talk to one advisor, David Blanchett from Morningstar, who said, you know, look, it is possible to live on $32,000, but it's not without its challenges. And it likely means drastic changes in your lifestyle, especially if you were used to living on much more prior to retirement. So the first key to living on a modest income, all the experts seem to suggest, would be no mortgage, no debt. And one advisor I spoke to said that most of his clients who are living on less than $32,000 don't have a mortgage. So that at least eliminates one really big expense that many people have, which is going into retirement. Housing represents at least one third of your expenses. And so if you can eliminate your mortgage, you may not be able to eliminate property taxes and property insurance and maintenance. But if you can eliminate your mortgage, it's a good way to at least live on a modest income. By the way, 70% of homeowners age 75 and older have paid off their mortgages, but only a third of those people ages 55 to 64 have done so. So there's a big gap between those people who are on retirement's doorstep who haven't paid off their mortgage and at least those later in retirement, the third stage of retirement, who have paid it off. So think about that, going into retirement without a debt, especially if you're going to have modest income. The other big expense is health care. So between mortgages and health care could represent about 50% of expenses. And healthcare as a slice of the pie represents anywhere from 12 to say 15% of your healthcare expenses, of your expenses in retirement. So making sure that you have, you know, not just Medicare in place, but also considering a Medicare supplement insurance policy could go at least a long way toward reducing those expected out-of-pocket expenses. And then having a plan in place for your unexpected healthcare costs would be necessary as well. And that was the one thing that Transamerica noted in this study, was that many of the people who they surveyed who are on modest incomes don't have adequate savings in necessary, you know, to cover these financial shocks from healthcare shocks. So that's two things. The third thing is, a lot of the people who go into retirement, whether they have modest income or not, don't have a financial plan in place. They have something, you know, at least it's not written. And I think the key, according to Collinson, when I spoke to her, was that having a retirement plan that's written is critical, especially when you live on a modest income in retirement. You need to have a sense of all your sources of income, and you need to have a good handle on your expenses, be it, you know, and categorize them. Are they fixed? Are they semi-variable? Are they discretionary? You're going to have to probably do away with many of the discretionary expenses, and then work really hard on trimming your fixed and semi-variables.
Well, and ultimately, this sounds like a drill that people should be looking to do themselves. The idea that says, okay, if you had to retire today, what's your income going to be? What would you have from Social Security? You know, and look at it as you've got forced retirement or what have you that's going to make you do this. If you had to retire today, what would be your income, and what would you have to do to be able to live on that?
Yeah, and I think that's especially critical. You know, if you haven't thought about what your income will be in retirement, and if it looks, you know, now would be a good time to do so. If it looks like it's going to be modest, it's really important then to not only get a handle on your sources of income and try to maximize those sources. You know, most of the people in the survey retired and took Social Security at 62, which led to a permanent reduction in their benefits, not just for themselves, but for their surviving spouses. So before the fact, if you can say, okay, what are the things, I know I'm going to have a modest income in retirement. I know Social Security will be modest. I know my pension might be modest. I know that my savings are modest. All these things, what can I do to maximize them? You know, delaying Social Security could be one of the greatest things that someone could do to at least help themselves and their surviving spouse. The other thing that they, you know, obviously need to think about is, you know, you've retired early, but if you're having trouble making ends meet, you perhaps need to think about not just trimming expenses, but maybe going back to work part-time. And that could be the difference between, you know, having, you know, struggling to make ends meet and maybe making ends meet without the struggle. Again, you may not never have an extravagant lifestyle, but at least, you know, working part-time could be the difference between, you know, all the financial worry that could come with not having enough
income. I was going to say, there's a lot of peace of mind that comes. You don't have to be necessarily living the high life, but if you've got peace of mind and you're not feeling like you're struggling, that's a heck of a lot better.
Yeah, and the last thing I'll mention, there's a silver lining. Even though these people have modest incomes, 9 in 10 say they're generally happy and enjoying life. So
we'll take it. Well, yeah, we'll take it. That's a good thing, because money can't necessarily buy that kind of happiness. So we like that, even though we find it pretty challenging. Bob, great stuff. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me on, Chuck.
Bob Powell is the editor at Retirement Weekly. For more information, find his columns at MarketWatch.com and follow the links to Retirement Weekly. You want to find out when his columns are up? Follow him on Twitter. He's at RJPIII. Money Life will be right back.
At Hightower, providing the best fiduciary advice to every advisory client is not just a job, it's a legal duty. Sophisticated asset management, lifetime financial planning and wealth management solutions. At Hightower, it all adds up to peace of mind. Visit HightowerAdvisors.com to learn more about the Hightower difference.
It's time for the big interview.
What is going on here? I demand an explanation.
The big names, the big news, the biggest stories, the next big thing. What's the big deal? It's the big interview.
It's the big stuff.
You talking to me?
Who do you think you are?
We have a big show for you tonight.
Money Life brings you the big thinkers, top experts, the brightest minds.
I don't know how to put this, but kind of a big deal.
And plenty of time to swim in their brain fluid.
Oh, my.
So listen and learn and enjoy the big interview.
The eyes of the nation are on us right now.
Whatever. Fun will now commence.
Well, when you listen to that intro and you hear us saying we're going to talk about the next big thing or what have you, well, today we're talking about the next fund. It's actually about two funds that were launched early this week, because Chautauqua Capital Management, part of the Baird funds, R.W. Baird, launched this week the Chautauqua Global Growth Fund and the Chautauqua International Growth Fund. And here to discuss the funds, international and global investing and more, is Brian Beitner. He's managing director and partner at Chautauqua Capital Management. And he is the portfolio manager for Chautauqua International Growth. That's CCWIX, and Chautauqua Global Growth, that's CCGIX. Brian Beitner, welcome to Money Life.
Thank you very much. It's great to be with you today.
Well, you say that at the start of the interview, but I have to say, the funny side to me was you guys just started these funds at the beginning of this week, and I, last week, had written a column that talked about how maybe the lexicon we use for funds is a bit outdated, that maybe we shouldn't be calling them international, global, and just large cap, because your basic large cap fund holds plenty of companies that do 40, 50, 60% of their revenues from international business. Your typical international fund has companies like Nestle and Toyota that get big chunks of their money from the United States. And then you got a global fund, which sort of combines the two, which might make the most sense for an investor looking for an all-in-one, but it still sort of has this flavor where it's going to go further afield and investors are maybe confused about how much of the money is leaving the docks. So for you, how big is the distinction? I mean, I recognize you have to call the funds something, but am I right that we're sort of old-fashioned in the vernacular that we're using? Or no, we need to use those names because that's all that anybody understands.
We think that you are exactly right, and that it's absolutely critical for investing to understand where the revenues are being generated. So at Chautauqua Capital, we quantify the geographic footprint on a revenue basis for every company that we include in the portfolio or consider for inclusion into the portfolio. And that enables us to understand the currency effects and the economic drivers in the markets where the companies are operating. But you're absolutely right. We're forever more in a world where where companies are multinational, where they're deriving revenues in multiple markets and experiencing costs in those markets. We can also characterize a company's currency makeup by this geographic footprint work we do to understand if a company is a global multinational or a domestic company. We still have plenty of companies in our universe and in our portfolio that are very domestic, that they're an American company or a Chinese company, in that both their costs and the revenues are being derived in a single currency. And then the area where there's the greatest risk and opportunity is where companies are manufacturing their products in one market and exporting them to other markets in the world. And if they're producing them in a purchasing power parity based currency that's expensive, and selling it elsewhere, they're going to face a headwind. And vice versa, if their home currency is cheap, they have a tailwind, which creates an opportunity for investors. But we do think about these things. We think they're very important, very critical. And the derivative of it is you can understand, you can then do a deep dive into the economic drivers country by country and better understand what sort of exposures you might have to a change in oil prices for retailers, industrial companies, transportation companies in a given country. But if they have to import most of their oil and the oil price is coming down, it benefits all sectors, not just the energy, not just energy sensitive sectors.
But that to me is very interesting, because I think most people, when they think of investing domestically versus internationally, do the process the exact reverse way that you were just talking about. They
right.
they think they and not necessarily surprising. I think I fall into this category myself. I think if I need international exposure, I need to be exposing myself to international economies and international markets to get better diversification. And I think of the economy and the market first, and the currency exposure to me is secondary. And what you're suggesting is that the currency exposure is perhaps primary, because that's where there's more of the specific risk, right?
No, to be clear, it's not a primary emphasis on currency. It's a primary emphasis on the economies that are driving growth and profitability for a given company. So we want to understand where companies are generating revenues, and not just stop and categorize the company by a certain nationality based on where they're headquartered. You use the example of Nestle. Nestle derives very little of their revenue from Switzerland. They derive much more of the revenue from the United States, but many people categorize Nestle as a Swiss company because that's where their headquarters is, and that's what they're reporting. The Swiss franc is their reporting currency. So to us, we want to understand the economic impact and the currency impact for each company in a portfolio. And further, you can improve your diversification without just flooding your portfolio with lots and lots of stocks. For example, we manage a 40-stock global portfolio and a subset 30-stock international portfolio. We can achieve tremendous diversification with a relatively concentrated portfolio by being very, very careful about the economic exposures for that portfolio. We need to think about Germany and South Korea as similar economic models. They're both industrial export economies. Think about Canada and Australia in a similar way, because they're both commodity-based, basic material-oriented economies, despite the fact that those two pairs of countries are in different parts of the world.
When you look out right now, obviously, with the global fund, you have the mandate that allows you to be buying domestics. You don't with the international fund. Are you finding that the U.S., in spite of the troubles that we had at the beginning of the year, is still the market that most folks are going to favor, and that the international selections, you got to be a little choosier?
Well, I think you have to be very choosy everywhere. Selectivity is critically important. And for the past few years, the U.S. has been the economic engine of the developed world and has grown more rapidly than Japan and most of Europe. We're now to a point where the dollar has rallied versus a number of world currencies, and U.S. producers are facing a little bit of an export headwind. We're now to the point where the EU growth rate is ticking up a little bit higher, while the U.S. growth rate is ticking down a little bit lower. And, you know, as we look across the global landscape, we've got a nicely appreciated dollar, attractive valuations outside of the United States. And we'd argue that there are, on a very selective basis, very attractive investment opportunities outside of the United States as well as inside of the United States.
When, you know, you talked about Nestle, can we flip that example around and pick a big domestic company and help my audience understand that? Because this is a discussion we sometimes have without the specificity. So is there, you know, I don't necessarily want to pick one, but if it was a McDonald's or a, you know, pick your favorite, that, and explain to my audience how you size it up and say, this is how we value it domestically versus globally.
So I think one might be able to argue that certain companies in the United States have bigger growth opportunities outside of the United States than inside of the United States. One example of that might be MasterCard. MasterCard is a dominant credit card processor in the United States with Visa, but our credit card usage is relatively mature. MasterCard has significant operations in Europe and through Asia, and they have a nice presence in markets where credit card adoption rates are growing and growing more rapidly. So for a company like MasterCard, the revenue opportunity outside of the United States is actually higher than it is in the U.S. Some of their participation rates, their take rates, and so forth vary market by market. And there are different regulatory regimes, but their growth opportunity is better outside of the U.S. than in the U.S.
Well, Brian, this has been great stuff. I appreciate you taking time out to join us. I wish we had a little bit more time. We'll just have to have you back to discuss things in the future, and good luck with the new funds.
Sounds good. Thank you very much for your kind words, and we appreciate the opportunity to speak again. Bye now.
Brian Beitner is Managing Director and Partner at Chautauqua Capital Management. He's Portfolio Manager of the Chautauqua International Growth Fund and the Chautauqua Global Growth Fund. For more information, go to ChautauquaCapital.com. By the way, they're part of the Baird Funds, which are on Twitter at RWBaird. All right, we are just about done with today's show, but we'll wrap things up when Money Life rolls on right after this message.
PowerShares provides a different take on traditional asset categories while providing advisors and investors with innovative investment opportunities. For more information, go to PowerShares.com. Invesco Distributors, Incorporated.
You know, I talk to money managers every single day, and I'd like to think I'm smart about this stuff and that I view things smartly and that I'm asking good questions. But I also point out that I'm not the expert, that my guests are the expert. That interview right there is the first time I think I've had a money manager tell me that he views Germany and South Korea as similar economies. Right? Did you hear that? Brian Beitner said that Germany and South Korea are similar economies. Both are industrial export economies. He also said that Canada and Australia were, because they're commodities-based. Now, Canada and Australia, I would have viewed as similar, not because, of course, of geographic proximity, and he made the point that geographic proximity had nothing to do with it. I would have assumed that Canada and Australia were similar, mostly because they sort of fit in the same range in the developed world in terms of economies. I wouldn't have thought about it necessarily that they're both so commodities driven as I would have looked at them that way, but I would have lumped them in the same because I don't really give much credence to some of the geographic side of things. I mean, yes, you can have something where you're saying, well, this is affecting North America, but I don't really view that it works that way. And yes, you certainly have things where you're talking about within the United States, but you know, I don't like, I think that like the local Nashville shares, that stuff is stupid. But Germany and South Korea, similar economies, evaluated the same way because they're both industrial export economies. I hadn't heard somebody say that because, of course, South Korea would normally be considered still developing in most people's minds. And so that makes it an emerging market. Interesting stuff. It's why we do it each day. We're still all learning. Hopefully you are too. And that's why you're here and you're entertained. Let me know what you think. Chuck at moneylifeshow.com. Tomorrow on this show, well, Ned Riley's going to be here. So that makes up for losing him today. Jack Ablin's going to be here from BMO Private Bank. Jeff Oxer is going to be here, and Greg McBride's going to be here. We will somehow manage to pack all of that into one show, even though technically those four interviews will run long. So because you've got Ned, who, what's the over-under on questions for Ned? Three? I get three questions to Ned in a 12-minute interview? Maybe. Maybe I get three. We'll see. We'll see. And if I cut down his interview time to just make it easy that it all fits, everything fits in the normal times, I definitely won't get three questions. So we're going to wind up Ned Riley and let him go. We got Jack Ablin coming tomorrow. That's going to be great. We'll find a way to make it all work, get you what you need so that you can get the best out of Money Life. We're sorry that today's show didn't quite turn out as expected, but hopefully you liked it. And let me know if you want me to do more of the times when I talk. I'm certainly happy to consider doing that. Sometimes it's easier for me. Sometimes it's more difficult. So I really like to be a little bit better prepared than I was today. But that's going to happen sometimes when you run a show like this. I want to thank my guests for today. I thought Brian Beitner was great. I loved getting a chance to chat with him. Bob Powell, of course, and Tom Lydon. I want to thank Rob Floyd, my producer, and I want to thank you because you are part of the reason why this is so much fun, a big part of the reason why this is so much fun. All right, today's Money Life quote of the day comes from Warren Buffett, who said, "I don't look to jump over 7-foot bars. I look around for 1-foot bars that I can step over." Yeah, 7 or 8 times, exactly. Yeah, we hope that you'll find that strategy works, and we hope you remember that, hey, until we do this again the next time, the best thing you can do for your money is not worry too much about it. Have a great day, everybody. We'll see you tomorrow.
The opinions expressed on Money Life are those of the host and guests only and reflect their personal thinking. They are not to be taken as representative policy or strategy of the organization that the host or guest represents. This show is a production of Money Life Radio, Inc., which retains all rights to its content. This broadcast, either in part or in its entirety, may not be retransmitted, reproduced, or rebroadcast without the express consent of Money Life Radio, Inc. This show is an informational service only. The information here is not to be considered a direct and personal recommendation for any individual to make a specific financial decision or transaction, but rather is meant as an informal resource to help investors make informed decisions. Always consult your financial advisor, accountant, or attorney before making any major financial decision. The information provided has been obtained from sources which are believed to be reliable, but is not guaranteed for either its accuracy or completeness.
So nice to meet you all. I hope you have a safe journey back home. And do come back anytime.